Franklin Roosevelt will long be remembered for his Herculean effort to bring America out of the Great Depression, his steadfast leadership during World War II, and for being the only president to serve more than two terms. Many would declare one of these accomplishments as the most defining of his presidency. But as David Kaiser argues, it was between the fall of France in June 1940 and the attack on Pearl Harbor on December 7, 1941, that Roosevelt made his greatest contribution to the course of American and world history. He writes about it in his new book, No End Save Victory, How FDR Led the Nation into War. And it's a great pleasure to welcome David Kaiser to the program. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Joe. I appreciate the opportunity.
David Kaiser has taught history at Harvard, Carnegie Mellon, the Naval War College, and Williams College. And this is his latest book, No End Save Victory. And how did you come to look at it in these terms of this defining moment in the FDR presidency?
Well, I've spent my life studying international politics and the origins of wars, so I knew this was a critical moment in world history. But I didn't realize until I did the research, I guess, two things. First of all, the extent to which the United States was really naked, militarily speaking, in the late spring and early summer of 1940, when France had fallen, when Britain was expected by just about everybody to be successfully invaded by Germany, and everybody, I think, includes Roosevelt, and when Japan then in September made an agreement with Germany to join in a war with the United States, if one took place. While we had one of the world's largest navies, it was not nearly large enough to face the situation that would arise if Britain were defeated. We had practically no army, and we had practically no air force, which was clearly now going to be a critical weapon. And what is incredible is that Roosevelt and the men around him, the men he brought into the government, including representatives of industry and labor, were able to do such extraordinary work and such extraordinary planning in the next 18 months that by the time of Pearl Harbor, we were not only planning for war, but we were planning for an unprecedented production effort to carry out a mission which Roosevelt had defined relatively recently, namely the complete defeat of all our possible enemies of both Germany and Japan.
One of the things that you write about in the book that is really interesting is that here was a president who believed that the involvement in this conflict was inevitable. And ultimately, you write about how he set up preparing the public for this, which was really interesting how he went about doing that.
Well, it is very interesting. And as you know, I quoted from a lot of his speeches, but I did that partly because I think they're wonderful, but partly to show the step-by-step way in which he did that. And it starts out in late summer 1937, when Japan is at war in China and things in Europe are threatening as well. And he gives the quarantine speech, as it's called, in Chicago, in which he says, the world is sinking into anarchy, aggressive states are run wild, and we cannot assume that this is not going to reach the Western Hemisphere without indicating what he has in mind. And it turns out he was willing to take some action against the Japanese if the British had gone along, but they wouldn't. So that's step one. Now, then, as France is falling in late May, he says, well, a lot of us have wanted to believe that we weren't threatened. I tried to point out that we were, but in any case, now we simply have to deal with this situation, and we're going to build 50,000 aircraft. And a month later, he proposes doubling the Navy, which is rushed through Congress. And a couple of months later, we put in a draft. But all the rhetoric until through 1940 is about defending the Western Hemisphere. And then you begin to see a shift at the turn of the year, and it's in the State of the Union that in January 41, that he says, not for the first time, that we're in a struggle to determine the fate of the world. with these dictator powers who have a completely different vision of a world ruled by force as opposed to a world ruled by law. And this is our high concept, and for that concept, there can be no end save victory, which is the first hint that defending the Western Hemisphere is not the limit of his ambitions. And there are a couple of other hints in that spring, but then in August, he meets with Churchill at sea off Newfoundland, and they issue the Atlantic Charter. And the Atlantic Charter lays out their plans for the post-war world after, and I quote, the destruction of the Nazi tyranny. That's really an amazing moment because we're not even in the war yet, but Roosevelt has committed us to the defeat of our main enemy. And a month earlier, he had written a confidential memorandum to Stimson, the Secretary of War, saying, I want you to draw up what it would take to defeat all our possible enemies, and that planning to reach that objective is already going on at the time of the Atlantic Charter, and it's finished in draft form by late September.
I hope you'll allow me to take a slight detour. I was fascinated in reading this book over the past week, and you used the word rhetoric, of taking the speeches and taking the statements that you used in the book of how the president was building his case and guiding the public to this point. And obviously, we are in a situation, a world situation now, where the world's powers are saying a lot of things, and it seems to often just be summed up as rhetoric. At what point do we start to look at it as more, and even in this case of look at it as that words mean things and that there's great power behind them?
Well, that is a very interesting question. I think that Vladimir Putin's speech immediately after the occupation and annexation of Crimea, in which he gave his view of how the world had been run for the last 20-plus years and what he thought was wrong with that, and indicated that at least in his backyard things were going to be different for a while, that is an example of a speech that has to be taken quite seriously. Now, let me see how I want to put this. President Obama is very careful in speech, particularly in the foreign realm. He's very careful not to promise more than he can deliver. I don't think he has the kind of overarching vision of the world that he wants that Roosevelt has. But you have to look at both speeches and what people are capable of and what they're doing. It is our good fortune that we're not living in the world they lived in of totalitarian regimes commanding really enormous resources, huge armies and navies raised by drafts that really can conquer medium-sized countries, leapfrog across continents or across oceans, et cetera, et cetera. That is not our world. And in fact, I frequently feel myself that the real danger we're threatened with is anarchy, not excessive organized force. But all I can say is you have to watch the rhetoric and listen to the rhetoric and watch what people are doing all the time. And in the same way, there's a lot of pretty frightening rhetoric in the Far East being thrown around between China and Japan right now. But nothing has happened. On the other hand, as I say, in 1937, a huge war began there that lasted for 8 years.
You also make the point, and to get back to the subject at hand, but also to use it as some comparison, that President Roosevelt had enormous political and social capital that he had built up during the New Deal years.
Absolutely.
To use to his advantage, which is something that this president does not have.
No, he doesn't. And to me, and I always describe myself as a New Deal, New Frontier Democrat, that is the tragedy of Barack Obama. He came in to office at a moment somewhat similar to Roosevelt, both in the midst of an economic crisis, although the one Roosevelt came in for had been lasting a good deal longer. Now, it seems to me that Roosevelt, master politician that he was, understood he had to bring the American people immediate relief in 1933. And a feeling of greater security. And he did both of those things. He secured the banking system And then, for various reasons, people were going back to work in 1933 and 34. Thus, he increased his congressional majorities in 1934. He was able to increase them again with a smashing reelection victory in 1936. Now, Barack Obama, who I think had almost as much freedom of action as Roosevelt when he came in, couldn't do that. And the economic situation continued getting worse, and it certainly wasn't improved at the time of the congressional election in 2010. And as a result, he lost his majority in the House of Representatives to a very hostile Republican Party, and it seems pretty clear that he's never going to get that majority back.
We talk a lot about coalition, and the coalition that President Roosevelt was able to bring together in the country of the nation, labor, business, minority groups, of being able to bring them together to fight a common enemy is an amazing process and also an amazing achievement when you look at it in the whole.
Yes, I really appreciate that you've read the book carefully, Joe, and that you saw what I wanted my readers to see. But he did that, as I say, starting in his inaugural address in 1933 by trying to enlist the nation in this great common enterprise of restoring our economy, of building a new and better America. And he allowed labor to make great gains. He certainly was good for business. Many businessmen didn't feel that, but some of the more enlightened ones did realize that. And he created a shared sense of purpose. And in addition, he was helped because it's very clear that everybody in May and June 1940 was worried about the threat to the Western Hemisphere, so he could draw on that. But again, one of the things that fascinated me about this was the response of the relatively excluded groups in the United States, particularly Negro Americans, as they called themselves then, who were sharing some in the New Deal, but who still lacked basic rights in much of the country and weren't being treated as equal citizens. But their response to this great enterprise was to want to be part of it, to want to be included. And that was the way they approached the war, that they wanted their men to fight in all capacities and to prove themselves. And they wanted an equal share of factory employment, et cetera, et cetera. And yes, I think that probably since another very fine president, John F. Kennedy, we have not had that kind of feeling in the United States again.
Looking at this period from June 1940 to December of 1941, it is interesting because you write about his generals and his admirals, those that are top ranking, coming to him and talking to him about the threats. And ultimately, he is more attuned than they are as to what the threats really are.
In some cases, that's true, and he has a broader strategic vision. The Army and the Navy are more attuned to defending the Western Hemisphere, although one exception to that is Admiral Stark, the Chief of Naval Operations, who I think really wanted to get into the war very early to try to save the British, which Roosevelt did not think we could risk doing in this period. But he, I think, foresees a world war, and he wants democracy to win, if at all possible. And thus, for instance, when Hitler attacks the Soviet Union in what turns out to be really the pivotal moment in the war, in June of 1941, the Army and probably the Navy as well think that the Soviets won't last out the year. They certainly don't want to waste any of our scarce resources on them, but Roosevelt sees that this could transform the whole situation. And if the Soviets don't collapse, it opens up the possibility of the complete defeat of Nazi Germany, and he therefore insists on giving them whatever they can, to the virtual despair of General Marshall and also Secretary Stimson. I did want to mention, if I may, one other interesting aspect of the way he mobilized public opinion. As you will recall, he appointed these very strong personalities in the cabinet, such as Henry Stimson, a Republican, and Frank Knox, another Republican, as Secretary of War and Navy. And he let them speak out, and speak out more forcefully about the war than he was. So that you have, during 1941, from relatively early in the year onward, Stimson and Knox making what amounts to blunt calls that we get into the war as soon as possible in public, even though Roosevelt wasn't allowed to do so. And again, I think it's an unfortunate feature of American politics today that cabinet members very rarely do that sort of thing anymore. The White House won't let them.
And ultimately, when you look at what was accomplished, and we look at this period, what was set up that allowed us victory, as you indicate in the title? Obviously, everything changed on December 7th, 1941. So we were in a fairly, even though a tragic circumstance, a fairly good place historically, militarily, and socially.
Well, we were in a good place socially because the nation was behind the president. We were in a dreadful situation militarily at that moment, particularly with the loss of much of the Pacific Fleet. And we were going to suffer very heavily at the hands of German submarines for, I think, the first 8 or 9 months of 1942, which was the worst period of the U-boat war. But the machinery had been set up, starting in the late spring of 1940, to plan the economy, to plan production, to expand production, and the plans had been laid for maximum production. Many new plants were already being built. Many more were planned. They were using some of the New Deal agencies to stimulate war production. And it's fascinating to me to read about these agencies. For instance, the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, which went back to Hoover, which was essentially a federal bank to lend money to worthwhile enterprises that couldn't get capital from private banks. We really could have used a replay of that back in 2009, but we didn't have it. And it was being used not only to build plants, but to buy up scarce raw materials all over the world. So we had the institution set up. We had the plans laid. But still, you'll remember this, this is practically the end of the narrative in the book. On December 9th, I think it is, Stimson, the Secretary of War, asks William Knudsen, one of the heads of the production agency, who had been the CEO of General Motors, can we reach our maximum production targets by July 1st, 1943, which was their original goal? And Knudsen says, no, we can't, but we can reach them by July 1st, 1944. And what is amazing to me, as I said, is that that turned out to be the date, almost exactly, at which the major decisive offensives against both Germany and Japan began. Still, though, I mean, everything was hanging fire, even in the first half of 1941. It wasn't clear the Soviet Union would hold out. Britain could be in danger if the Soviet Union collapsed. We couldn't get anything to Europe at that point. But if things went well, within a year or two, we were going to be in a great position. And that is what Roosevelt had brought about.
Ultimately, what do you hope people get out of the telling of this time period?
Well, I think the biggest thing I hope they get out of it is to see how different things could be in those days and how they could be again. And by that, I mean not only the capacity of the country to pull together to solve a great task and to make sacrifices, including 90% marginal tax rates, but to base our public policy on moral values, which is what Roosevelt insisted on from the word go, both with respect to the economy and with respect to the state of the world. And particularly with regard to domestic policy, we are ruled, it seems to me, now by the profit motive. Many Americans think we should be ruled even more by it. Roosevelt, in that first inaugural, said that is what has got us to the mess that we're in right now with 25% unemployment and a collapsing banking system, that we need to operate based on moral values other than pure profit. and he wanted to make sure we would do that. Sooner or later, I think that spirit is going to be revived in the United States, and I'm trying to show my readers what it could accomplish in those days.
The title of the book is No End, Save Victory, How FDR Led the Nation into War. It is published by Basic Books. David Kaiser, a great pleasure to have you share your expertise with us. Thank you very much.
It was a pleasure for me, Joe. Thank you, and thank you for your careful attention to the book.
I appreciate it. Thank you. Again, the title of the book, No End, Save Victory, How FDR Led the Nation into War. It is published by Basic Books. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.